are going to be feasting throughout this conference as we listen to leaders bring to us their thoughts. And our next speaker is an Anglican priest, Canon Ted Karpf. Canon Karpf first came to my attention when he was the assistant to Bishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa, leading out in the Anglican Church's involvement with HIV and AIDS. He then came to the World Health Organization and began the program of involvement of faith-based organizations in the procurement of medicines for HIV. Subsequently, he moved to the Office of Partnerships, which was recently formed in the World Health Organization because of the recognition that faith-based organizations need to be a member in the discussion halls of health. Canon Karpf has written or edited a book that I mentioned briefly yesterday called Decent Care, it's called Restoring Hope. But the thesis of that book is that we can restore hope through decent care. And it is a great pleasure for me to invite Ted Karpf to come and address us as a group. He is a beautiful speaker, and he presents a beautiful message. Ted, thank you.
Good morning. Could you all stand, please? If there are seats empty in the middle, I'm going to ask that you move in toward the middle because there's about 25 people at the top who can't quite get down here. There's also a few empty chairs down here in the front. There's 5 chairs right down here. Now, while we're standing, because it's still church in my mind, is there a chorus that we can sing together that everybody knows? And if so, somebody start it, because I can't. Now, come on. It's a church. Can't you come up with one chorus? Thank you. Say magnifique. One of the things I've become famous for at the World Health Organization is I've brought trade unions, faith-based organizations, and all manner and sorts of people to the 7th floor conference room, and invariably we will sing a chorus. And that sends a shockwave down the hall to the Director General's office, who says he's trying to convert us again. So thank you very much. It is a privilege to stand in this place because my acquaintance with you actually goes back now nearly 20 years. Through the work of Harvey Elder and many of those at Loma Linda, my work in HIV starting in Dallas, Texas, in the United States, 30 years ago, began in that place with that community, taking a hint from a church that was rather unknown to many people, though growing up in Texas, we had a lot of Adventists around Dallas and Fort Worth, but a church we didn't understand. But for me, I understood one thing. And in spite of what people said and what magazines wrote, there was an immense compassion that came from the people at Loma Linda toward these young men dying with a disease of immune suppression. From that point on, I was introduced to your church in more formal ways, and I've even made all the historic sites. I lived in Tacoma Park for a number of years. I walked through the campus of Columbia. I landed in the cornfields of northern Indiana and went to Berrien Springs, and then this year completed the pilgrimage by visiting Loma Linda, the place where God at least resides on occasion. I also appreciated the story of Mrs. White, who got off a train in that town and said, "We will build a university here." And for some reason, you all believed it. I visited the School of Public Health, and for me today is a privilege to stand in front of the august faculties of many Adventist institutions gathered in this place. I bow to you. I respect you. And I'm deeply appreciative that you are here with us. Last night was a historic moment for many, many reasons. But you are the first faith community to gather en masse at the World Health Organization. And you are the first ever to be seated en masse in the executive board room, our mini United Nations. The leadership of the organization welcomes you to Geneva and welcomes you here. I also want to turn your attention ever so gently to the disclaimer on the first page of the program, which says very clearly, the opinions expressed in this place do not reflect any of the institutions represented in this room, and particularly that of the WHO, but are merely the thoughts of individuals. And please respect that. What I am going to talk about, though, begins where we finished last evening. It is a strange combination for me, but not for you, to be standing here as both a cleric and a public health professional. It is part of your history, but as an Anglican, I have to say, it is not part of mine. And it is not necessarily part of our church. And it is not part of the World Health Organization. I am the first serving priest, because I still say Mass and preach on Sunday in this city and in 22 other cities across Europe every single week, and continue to follow my vocation as a priest, which just along the way led me into the World Health Organization. Part of that came about because of my work in Southern Africa, working in the community and working worldwide through the Anglican Communion to build a response to HIV and AIDS. But more specifically and more importantly, it reflects something of the fact that I live with one foot planted in each world and try to live in a way that allows me both the opportunity and the freedom to give witness to the faith that is in me, but never say what it is, because that is a boundary in the places where I live and work. What amuses me and has for 30 years is I have taken up positions with the Centers for Disease Control, with the U.S. government, with the Health Resources and Services Administration, the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, and now most recently the WHO, is that approximately 4.5 to 5 years into being in a community like that, everyone in the organization starts calling me father. I have never used that title in any of my professional work in those organizations, but the community around me insists you're not like the rest around here. We're calling you Father, and you just have to learn to live with it. I've often said that God chose me to be a priest because God didn't trust me to be a layman. And what I mean, and it's biblical, and it's there in Corinthians, God chose what is weak to shame the strong, what is stupid to shame the wise. And in all of that, so I am stupid, I am weak, and I'm desperately in need of something more than what the world of government and public health has to offer. Nonetheless, the way I came to understand public health was sitting down after I'd been recruited by Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, one of our great Surgeon Generals in the United States, who beyond his own religious conviction moved to an openness that even the conservative communities in America could not understand. He embraced the value of compassion, and particularly in the face of HIV. In that community, he invited me to become part of a solution. And I sat down and I was lectured to by a gentleman in the history of public health who pioneered sexually transmitted disease control in southern Louisiana from 1939 to 1979. And he sat with me and lectured me every day. And finally, about 6 weeks into it, I said, Jerry, I think I get what public health is about. And he said, what is it? And I said, it's essential evangelism. And he looked at me and he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, what you're really offering is the promise that somebody might live a little longer if they change their ways. And the only difference between church people and public health people is our idea of longer is longer than public health. With that, he understood that I got it, that my job in public health was to convert the brokenhearted, the downtrodden, and the acting out. And I've done that every day since. Today I want to share with you something of the struggle I've had in trying to make sense out of the last 30 years of HIV. And I say 30 because the first person in my congregation to die of immune suppression, later understood as AIDS, was in 1979. I saw it then, and 150 deaths later in my congregation, I would come to understand it very deeply. Where I have to begin is in the place I suggested to you, and it is the place called compassion. I can't speak to you of spirituality because my role at the WHO prohibits that per se. But I want to go to the action that underlies all compassion. It begins in the Latin word compati, to suffer with, compassion. And that is not unique to Christians or Jews or Muslims. It is not unique to non-believers or public health experts. It is that place that moved us. And throughout the biblical texts of all religions, you begin to come to note that compassion is a hallmark of faithfulness. The Buddha invited people to compassion. Jesus of Nazareth, the prophets of old, all invited people to a place. The prophet, may his name be blessed, called people into compassion first. And when Muhammad understood the name of God, the first of the 99 names is compassion. When we read the Vedas of the Hindu tradition, we understand immediately that at the heart of it is the notion of compassion, and that the purpose of rebirth and new life is to be born finally into a heart and soul, which is compassion. What I saw in HIV, I tried to bring back to the world in a 30-year reflection. And I didn't want to tell a story of death and heartbreak, of rejection and indignity. What I wanted to tell was, where did I see compassion? And how could I move it beyond one location to say, this is the standard for life and for health? Indeed, even the WHO studied something of compassion beginning in the 1980s. And it turns up curiously in the quality of life surveys, which are now around the world, but were created in that building you were in last evening. Compassion, you see, is a universal attribute of faith. We know it, we've heard it, we've experienced it as our own. Before the establishment of secular or government or publicly supported health systems, which only dates back to the 1800s, religious communities, motivated by their calling for compassion, offered remedies for sickness and care to the suffering. This was the case of temples, mosques, monasteries, and churches. Some resembled the ancient practice of providing refuge and care within a traditional community. The first hospital in the world was created not in Europe, not in the Middle East, but in fact in Asia. It was the teaching of the Buddha that the highest form of compassion and enlightenment would be found in the care of the sick. The degree of explicit religious intent apparent in these activities varies considerably, but each has been inspired by their core values, which we've been hearing a lot about in the last 2 days already. This value of compassion, this call to care for the sick, each of them has a beginning, a place of centrality in the formation of the religious system itself. In caring for others, religious and non-religious communities not only act out of compassion, but also act out of an ethic of decency, which is my point of entry. The ethic of decency prescribes values and principles about how to treat others in accord with their humanity. It is an expression, perhaps, of our highest wish that all will be one. In that, the ethic demands that care is provided to meet people's individual needs and respects their dignity and worth. Thank you, Dr. Paulson, for reminding us of where our roots are and where we all must begin. Out of respect for dignity and agency is the imperative that healthcare systems, particularly those offered by faith-inspired or faith-based or faith-related communities, must provide individuals with care that is comprehensive and holistic and that meet the needs of the whole person. And I must confess to you, having traveled through the Adventist health systems, my visit at Loma Linda, particularly to the West Hospital, was to me one of the most overwhelming experiences I have ever had. Because what I saw was the application of these values in very basic and concrete terms. And I learned from the work of Gerald Winslow and Carla Gober and a whole team of people that that wasn't unique in just that physical location, but was and is the prevailing philosophy of health and wholeness for the world. I applaud you in that. Give yourselves a hand. Built on the foundation of the primary health care movement, which you heard mentioned last night, that notion of the Alma Ata Declaration, if you've never read it, read it. It expresses the highest ambitions of humanity toward the care for others, and in its own words moves us to a notion of prevention and health promotion. It's not merely about caregiving in a hospital or clinic. It's about how do communities, nations, and individuals take the responsibility for care. There is much in your tradition that could nurture the world if you would at least tell us. How do you get to that place of proclaiming a gospel that also holds in tandem the notion of health and lifestyle? The world needs to know. Decent care, though, focuses not only on the quality of the care offered, which is crucial, but considers seriously the input of those receiving this care. And this, for me, is what I saw change in the midst of HIV. In those early years, doctors and nurses and health caregivers were utterly terrified about this disease that caused the suppression of an immune system. Some of you may recall it was gloves, white coats, masks. People came into rooms looking like they were from another planet and heavily scented with all kinds of disinfectant, both before and after. It was so dramatic that people like me, just the ordinary clergy types, when after sitting at a bedside of a man suffering from HIV, covered with Kaposi's sarcoma, suffering with tuberculosis, and dying from pneumocystis infection, sitting in his room when they finally declared that he was one of those people, this army of sterile precautions was loaded around the door. The year was 1984. I came out of the room after he had wept on my shoulder about his approaching death. I looked at the nursing staff who were aghast because they didn't know someone was in there without precautions. And I said, what can I do in the face of a clear problem? I've been exposed in this way. And the chief nurse looked at me and said, well, you better start running. And I said, from the hospital? No, you should run every day to get all that infection out of your lungs. And I looked at her and I said, if I do that, you'll find me on the side of the road dead. And she said, why? And I said, it's 110 outside. Walking a mile would kill me under these conditions. But it was terror. And it was only compassion that got me through the door and out. And it was in that moment that I called my friends at CDC, my partner, at the time was an epidemiologist with CDC, and I said, so what are the likelihoods of my death? And they said, how old are you? I said, 33. Not likely soon. And that was it. And then we talked about HIV, and I began my 30-year relationship with Jim Curran, one of the real discoverers of what had happened at CDC. And Jim and I have remained friends, and he says to me to this day, he said, the notion that a priest would actually call the CDC for help was to me overwhelming. And see, he knew Berrien Springs. He went to Notre Dame. But what we learned and saw in those years is that communities of people had to take up the responsibility for their own care. By and large, healthcare institutions didn't want it, and so communities did it, and it was the transformative moment. It was the place where I can recall vividly standing in the midst of community and praying for help and vision and opportunity because there was none. And there was no healing, and there was no cure. And I learned a new definition of healing that has changed my life. Healing, the transformation of body, mind, or spirit to a transformed life of love. When I looked at the miracles, I realized they weren't merely physical manifestations, They were soulful manifestations. And nobody, after the encounter with the great healer, ever returned to life as it was. That's true in the midst of HIV. The elements I've learned now and struggled with, and I'm going to give them to you very briefly because I'm in 5 different workshops in the next 3 days doing exactly the same thing. But they come out this way, very simply. And these are by convergence, not by consensus. I have put together a world of people in that globalization that Dr. Paulson described, and in that world have called into being communities around the world whose consciousness has been raised to recognize that decency stands at the heart of all care. In a few short weeks, I'm sitting down with a writing team, and we will produce the definitive statement on what is decent care. But for the moment, let me share 6 values that speak to it. Those values are dignity and agency. These are the personal values. Agency is a word that comes out of the experience of the liberation movements of the late 20th century. We've often talked about empowering patients, but what I've noticed watching human beings for many years is that we empower no one to have enough power to overcome us. Thereby, it is not empowerment, it is merely permission. To move away from that approach, that unequal system and method, look at the notion of agency. Agency begins in the place that as a human being born, you have the possibility and the capacity to make choices and decisions. This has huge impact for children. It has huge impact for the mentally ill and those whose developmental skills will never exceed a certain low point. Nonetheless, people can make choices and must be treated as such. It begins in a medical encounter very simply. When the person in the white coat walks into the room and starts an examination, to simply ask one question, may I touch you? May I touch you? Recognizing the individual has a right to say, no, you may not. Or, yes, you can, but please tell me why. It begins there, agency, the notion that people are agents in the development and implementation of lifestyle choices, health, and health care. It extends all the way into the notion of how treatment will be enacted and implemented around them, and it extends into prevention and promotion. It begins in the place that we all make choices. Likewise, when someone has agency, you recognize their dignity. I don't need to belabor the point, but that's the individual value. The community value around that, the community values are 2, and I've seen them already in presentations both from PAHO and from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and there are 2, interdependence and solidarity. Solidarity, again, a word of the liberation movements, because in solidarity, the patient knows that the healthcare team is on their side. In interdependence, we recognize that as patients, we need doctors, but also doctors and nurses need patients. And they need it both ways, patients as in persons, and patients as in the ability to stand back and wait. But we all need that, don't we? How many of us wouldn't be here today if a teacher or a parent or a friend or a respected peer said to us, hold on a minute, and who walked with us on our own journeys to excellence how many of us would not be here if that person hadn't done it? Interdependence and solidarity, the simple recognition that we are not in this alone, we are in this together. And finally, the last two values, which also speak to resource, because you're going to hear resource, limited resource, resource allocation, resource deprivation in almost every health conversation around the world today. It's the way everyone talks about it. And there are two values. They are subsidiarity and sustainability. Now, sustainability is a word often used by those in the Northern Hemisphere to discriminate against those in the South, saying, if you can't prove it's sustainable, you can't do it. The problem with that was, and is, if it was sustainable, I wouldn't be asking. So sustainability means something slightly different. It means when a community embraces a project or a program, and the community applies that program in its community and among the people, even though the resources may go away, the program continues, because that's what's really sustainable. I saw that outside on the outskirts of Loma Linda at the old Air Force base. And there is an extraordinary community health center, and it is sustainable because the heart and soul of the people demand that it be. Likewise, subsidiarity is about when communities decide on the resource allocation, not structures outside of them, about what's good for them. And in the limited way, they have the right to make a choice and to move forward. That's what subsidiarity is about, making choices. I want to finish then with this word. Why be healthy at all? What does it mean? And I have to say, all the years I've been putting into public health, people have asked me around the world, why be healthy at all? And here is my response. Health in and of itself is of no particular value. But health, to make meaning, to make choices, health, to flourish as human beings, that is worth keeping, and it is why we would dare be healthy. We are healthy because it gives us life, and where we are alive, the opportunity for life exists. My brothers and sisters, friends and colleagues from WHO and PAHO, thank you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the chance to do decent care.